catches her attention. She opens it. Medals from Jaidi's Muay Thai championships gleam. Kanya hands them over to the silent boys. They cluster around the evidence of their father's triumphs as Kanya finishes going through the papers.
There's something in here,
Niwat says. He holds up an envelope.
Is this for us as well?
It was with the medals. Kanya shrugs, continuing to go through the box.
What's in it? Pictures.
Kanya looks up, puzzled.
Let me see.
Niwat passes them across. Kanya shuffles through them. They seem to be a record of suspicious people that Jaidi was interested in. Akarat figures in many. Farang, many photos of Farang. Smiling photos of men and women around the minister like ghosts, hungry to suck at his blood. Akarat, unaware, smiling with them, happy to be standing with them. Kanya shuffles more photos, men she doesn't recognize. Trader Farang, presumably. Here, a fat one, glutted on calories from abroad. Some per-cal or agrigen representative visiting from Coangrit, perhaps, looking to curry favor in the newly opening kingdom where trade is in ascendancy. There, another, the Carlisle man who lost his dirigible. Kanya smiles slightly. How that one must have hurt. She flips past the photo and sucks in her breath, stunned.
What is it?
Niwat asks.
What's wrong? Nothing.
Kanya forces herself to say.
It's nothing.
The photo is of herself, drinking with Akarat on his pleasure barge. A long lens. A bad image, but herself, clearly.
Jaidi knew.
Kanya stares at the photo for a long time, forcing herself to breathe. Staring at the photo. Meditating on karma and duty while Jaidi's sons watch her solemn. Meditating on her patron who never spoke of this photo. Meditating on what a man of Jaidi's stature knows, and what he does not reveal, and what secrets can cost a person. She studies the photo, debating. Finally, she pulls it and puts it in her pocket. The rest, she shoves back into the envelope.
Was it a clue?
Kanya nods solemnly. The boys nod back. They do not ask for more. They are good boys. She goes over the rest of the room carefully, looking for other evidence that she might have missed, but finds nothing. Finally, she bends down to pick up the box of equipment and files. It's heavy, but none of it weighs as heavily as the photo that now sits in her breast pocket, like a coiled cobra. Outside in the open air, she forces herself to breathe deeply. The stink of shame is strong in her nostrils. She can't make herself look back at the boys in the doorway. The orphans who pay the price for their father's unbending bravery. They suffer because their father chose an opponent worthy of him. Instead of shaking down noodle carts and night markets, he chose a true enemy, an implacable and relentless one. Kanya closes her eyes.
I tried to tell you. You shouldn't have gone. I tried.
She straps the box of belongings to her cycle's cargo rack and pedals across the compound. By the time she arrives at the main administrative building, she has recovered. General Pracha stands under the shade of a banana tree, smoking a gold-leaf cigarette. She is surprised that she can meet the man's eyes. She approaches and whys. The general nods, accepting Kanya's greeting. You have his belongings? Kanya nods. And you've seen his sons? She nods again. He scowls. They piss in our house. On our own doorstep they leave his body. It should not be possible, and yet here, within our own ministry, they throw down their challenge. He grinds out the cigarette. You're in charge now, Captain Kanya. Jaidi's men are yours. It's time that we fought as Jaidi always wished. Make the trade ministry bleed, Captain. Get our face back. Chapter 21. On the crumbling tower's precipice, Emiko stares north. She has done it every day since Raleigh confirmed the wind-up land. Ever since Anderson Sama hinted that it was possible. She cannot help herself. Even when she lies in Anderson Sama's arms. Even when he sometimes invites her to stay with him, paying her bar fines for days at a time, she cannot help dreaming of that place without patrons. North. She breathes deep, taking in the scents of sea and burning dung and the bloom of orchid creepers. Down below, the wide delta of the Chao Phraya laps at Bangkok's levees and dikes. On the far side, Don Buri floats as best it can on bamboo rafts and stilt houses. The Temple of the Dawn Sprung rise from the water, surrounded by the rubble of the drowned city. North. Shouts come from below, breaking her reverie. It takes a moment for her brain to translate the noise filtering up, but then her mind shifts from Japanese to Thai, and the sounds become words. The words become screams.
Be quiet! My Yao! No, 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 no! Down! Map long Yao Ni! On your face! Please, 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 get down!
She cocks her head, listening to the altercation. She has good hearing. Another thing the scientists gave her, along with her smooth skin, and her dog-like urge to obey. She listens. More screams. The thought of footsteps and something breaking. Her nape prickles. She wears nothing but slim pants and a string halter. Her other clothing lies below, awaiting her change into street clothes. More shouts filter up. The scream of someone in pain, primal, animal pain. White shirts. A raid. Adrenaline surges through her. She has to get off the roof before they arrive. Emiko turns and runs for the stairs but stops short at the stairwell. The tramp of feet echoes up.
Squad 3, clear!
Wing clear!
Secure!
She shoves the door closed and presses her back to it, trapped. Already they clog the stairwells. She casts about the rooftop looking for another escape route.
Check the roof!
Emiko sprints for the edge of the tower. 30 feet below, the first of the tower's balconies extends. A penthouse balcony, from a time when the tower must have been luxurious. She stares down at the tiny balcony, dizzy. Below it, there is nothing but the plunge to the street, and the people who fill it, like black spider mites. Wind gusts tugging her toward the edge. Emiko sways and barely catches her balance. It's as if the spirits of the air are trying to kill her. She stares down at the balcony. No, it's impossible. She turns and runs back to the door, searching for something to wedge it shut. Chips of brick and tile litter the rooftop, along with the clothing draped on drying lines, but nothing. She spies a piece of an old broom. Scrambles for it and jams it against the door frame. The door's hinges are so rusted that it sags with the pressure she applies. She shoves the broom handle tighter against it, grimacing. The weather awl of the broom is stronger than the metal of the door. Emiko casts about for another solution. She's already boiling from running back and forth like a frantic rat. The sun is a thick red ball, sinking for the horizon. Long shadows stretch across the broken surface of the building's roof. She turns in a panicked circle. Her eyes fall on the clothing and the lines. Perhaps she can use the rope to climb down. She runs to the clotheslines and tries to yank one off, but it's tough and well-tied. It won't come free. She yanks again. Behind her, the door shutters. A voice on the other side curses.
Open up!
The door jumps in its frame as someone slams against it, trying to force past her improvised brace. Inexplicably, she hears Gendo-sama in her head, telling her she is perfect, optimal, delightful. She grimaces at the old bastard's voice as she yanks again on the line, hating him, hating the old snake who loved her and discarded her. The line cuts into her hands but refuses to give way. Gendo-sama, such a traitor. She will die because she is optimal, but not optimal enough for a return ticket.
I'm burning up.
Optimal. Another thud from behind her. The door cracks. She gives up on the line, turns in another circle, searching desperately for a solution. There is nothing except rubble and the open air all around. She might as well be 1,000 miles high. Optimally high. A hinge shatters, throwing bits of metal. The door sags. With a final glance at the door, Emiko sprints again for the edge of the building, still hoping for a solution, a way to climb down. She stops, windmilling at the edge. The precipice yawns, the wind gusts. There is nothing. No handholds, no way to climb. She looks back at the clotheslines.
If only...
The door breaks from its hinges. A pair of white shirts spill through, stumbling, waving spring guns. They catch sight of her and charge across the roof.
You! Come here!
She peers over the edge. The people are dots far below. The balcony is as small as a postage envelope.
Stop! Yu Diaoni! Halt!
The white shirts are running for her, running full bore, and yet somehow, strangely, they suddenly seem slow. Slow as honey on a cold day. Emiko watches them, puzzled. They are halfway across the roof, but they are so very, very slow. They seem to be running through rice porridge. Their every motion drags so slow as the man who chased her in the alleys and tried to knife her. So slow. Emiko smiles. Optimal. She steps up onto the roof ledge. The white shirts' mouths open to shout again. Their spring guns rise, seeking her. Emiko watches their slit barrels zero in on her, wonders absently if perhaps she is actually the slow one, if gravity itself will be too slow. The wind gusts around her, beckoning. The spirits of the air tug at her, blow the black net of her hair across her eyes. She pushes it aside, smiles calmly at the white shirts, still running, still pointing their spring guns, and steps backward into open air. The white shirt's eyes widen. Their guns glint red. Discs spit toward her. 1, 2, 3. She counts them as they fly. 4, 5. Gravity yanks her down. The men in the projectiles disappear. She smashes into the balcony. Her knees slam into her chin. Her ankle twists as metal shrieks. She rolls, crashing into the balcony's railing. It shatters and peels away, and she plunges into open air. Emiko grabs for a broken copper balustrade as she goes over, yanks to a stop, dangling above an abyss. Empty air yawns all around, beckoning freefall. Hot wind gusts, tugs at her. Emiko pulls herself up to the listing balcony, gasping. Her whole body is shaking, feels bruised, and yet All her limbs still work. She has not broken a single bone in the fall.
Optimal.
She swings a leg up onto the balcony and hauls herself to safety. Metal grinds. The balcony sags under her weight, its ancient bolts loosening. She's burning up. She wants to collapse, to let herself slide from her precarious ledge and pour into the open air. Shouts from above. Emiko looks up. White shirts peer over the edge, aiming their spring guns at her. Discs pour down like silver rain. They ricochet, slash her skin, spark on metal. Fear gives her strength. She lunges for the safety of the balcony's glass doors. Optimal. The doors shatter. Glass slices her palms. Sparkling shards envelop her, and then she's through the glass and in the apartment, and she's running fast, blurringly fast. People are staring at her, shocked, impossibly slow. Frozen. Emiko smashes through another door and out into the hall. White shirts surround her. She plunges through them. Their surprised shouts are leaden as she streaks past. Down the stairwells, down, down, down the stairs, leaving the white shirts far behind. Shouts from high above. Her blood is on fire. The stairwells burn. She stumbles, leans against a wall. Even the heat of the concrete is better than her skin. She's becoming dizzy, but still she stumbles on. Men shout from above, chasing after her. Their boots thump on the stairs. Around and around and down she goes. She shoves through obstructing knots of people, jams herself between dwellers rousted by the raid. She is delirious with the furnace inside her. Tiny beads of sweat speckle her skin, forcing their way out through her absurdly designed pores, but in the heat and humidity, it does nothing to cool her. She has never felt moisture on her skin before. Always, she is dry. She brushes against a man. He recoils in surprise from her blazing skin. She's burning up. She cannot blend amongst these people. Her limbs move like the flash frame pages of a child's animation book, fast, 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 but choppy. Everyone is staring. She turns from the stairwell and jams through a door, stumbles down a hall, leans against a wall, panting. She can hardly keep her eyes open with the fire that burns within.
I jumped, she thinks. I jumped.
Adrenaline and shock. Cocktail terror. Giddy, amphetamine high. She's shaking. A wind-up's jitters. She's boiling, faint with heat. She presses herself against the wall, trying to absorb its cool.
I need water. Ice.
Emiko tries to control her breathing, to listen, to know where the exterminators come from, but her mind is dizzy and clouded. How far down is she? How many flights?
Keep moving. Keep going.
Instead, she collapses. The floor is cool. Her breath saws in and out of her lungs. Her halter is torn. There is blood on her arms and hands where she went through the glass. She stretches out, fingers wide, palms pressed to tile, trying to absorb the coolness of the floor. Her eyes close.
Get up!
But she can't. She tries to control her beating heart and listen for her pursuers, but she can barely breathe. She's so hot, and the floor is so cool. Han sees her. Voices exclaim and drop her, grab her again. Then the white shirts are all around, dragging her down the stairs, and she's grateful, thankful that they're at least dragging her down and out into the blessed evening air, even as they scream at her and slap her. Their words wash over her. She can't understand any of it. It's all just sounds, dark and dizzy heat. They do not speak Japanese. They are not even civilized. None of them are optimal. Water splashes over her. She gags and chokes. Another deluge in her mouth, her nose, drowning her. People are shaking her. They yell into her face, slap her, ask questions, demand answers. They grab her hair and jam her face down into a bucket of water, trying to drown her, to punish her, to kill her, and all she can think is, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Because some scientist made her optimal. And in another minute, this slip of a wind-up girl that they shout at and slap will be cool. Chapter 22. The white shirts are everywhere. Inspecting passes, stalking through food markets, confiscating methane. It's taken hours for Huk Sung to cross the city. Rumors say that all the Malayan Chinese have been interned in the yellow card towers. That they're about to be shipped south, back across the border to the mercy of the green headbands. Huk Sung listens to every whisper as he scuttles through the alleys on his way back to his cash and gems, sending Native Mai ahead of him, using her local's accent to scout. By the time night falls, they are still far from his destination. Spring life stolen money weighs heavy on him. At times, he fears that Mai will suddenly turn on him and report him to the white shirts in return for a share of the cash he carries. At other times, he mistakes her for a daughter mouth and wishes he could protect her from everything that is coming. I'm going mad, he thinks, to mistake some silly Thai girl for my own. And yet still, he trusts the slight girl, the child of fish farmers, who previously proved so obedient when he still had a scrap of managerial authority, and who he prays will not turn on him now that he is a target. Darkness falls completely.
Why are you so frightened?
Mai asks. Huk Sung shrugs. She does not, cannot understand the complexities swirling around them. For her it is a game. Frightening to be sure, but still a game.
When the brown people turned on the yellow people in Malaya, it was like this. All at once, everything was different. The religious fanatics came with their green headbands and their machetes.
He shrugs.
The more careful we are, the better.
He peers out into the street from their hiding place and ducks back. A white shirt is pasting up another image of the tiger of Bangkok, edged in black.
Jaidi Rojana Sukchai.
How quickly he falls from grace, and then rises like a bird to sainthood. Huk Sung grimaces. A lesson of politics. The white shirt moves on. Huk Sung scans the street again. People are starting to come out, encouraged by the relative cool of the evening. They walk through the humid darkness, coming out to do their shopping, to find a meal, to locate a favorite Somtom cart. White shirts glow green under approved burn methane. They move in teams, hunting like jackals for wounded meat. Small shrines to Jaidi have appeared before storefronts and homes. His image, surrounded by flickering candles and draped with marigolds, displaying solidarity and begging for protection against white shirt rage. Accusations fill the airwaves on national radio. General Pracha speaks of the need to protect the kingdom from those, carefully unnamed, who would topple it. His voice crackles over the people, tinny from hand-cranked radios. Vendors and housewives, beggars and children. The green of the methane lamps turns skin shimmery. A carnival. But amongst the rustle of sarongs and pasin and the clank of red and gold megadont handlers, there are always the white shirts, hard eyes, looking for an excuse to vent their rage.
Gone.
Huk Sung prods Mai forward.
See if it is safe.
A minute later, Maya's back motioning for him, and they are off again, threading through the crowds. Knots of silence warn them when new white shirts are near, fear-sending laughing lovers silent and children running. Heads duck low as the white shirts pass. Hak Sung and Mai work their way past a night market. His eyes rove over candles, frying noodles, Cheshire shimmers. A shout rises ahead of them. Mai darts forward, scouting. She's back a moment later, tugging at his hand.
Kun, come quickly, they're distracted.
And then they're slipping past a clot of white shirts and the object of their abuse. An old woman lies beside her cart, her daughter at her side, clutching a shattered knee. A crowd has gathered as the daughter struggles to drag her mother upright. All around, the glass cases that held their ingredients are shattered. Shards glitter in chili sauce, amongst bean sprouts, on lime, like diamonds under the green light of methane. The white shirts stir through the woman's ingredients with their batons.
Come, Auntie, there must be some more money here. You thought you could bribe white shirts, but you haven't done nearly enough to burn untaxed fuel.
Why are you doing this?
The daughter cries.
What have we done to you?
The white shirt studies her coldly.
You took us for granted.
His baton crashes down on her mother's knee again. The woman shrieks and the daughter cowers. The white shirt calls to his men.
Put their methane tank in with the rest. We have three more streets to go.
He turns to the watching silent crowd. Hak Sung freezes as the officer's eyes travel across him.
Don't run. Don't panic. You can pass as long as you don't speak.
The white shirt smiles at the watching people.
Tell your friends what you see here. We are not dogs you feed with scraps. We are tigers. Fear us!
And then he raises his baton, and the crowd scatters, Hak Sung and Mai with them. A block later, Hak Sung leans against a wall, panting with the effort of their flight. The city has grown monstrous. Every street holds hazard now. Down the alley, a hand-cranked radio crackles with more news. The docks and factories have been shut down. Access to the waterfront is restricted to those with permits. Hak Sung suppresses a shiver.
It's happening again.
The walls are going up and he is stuck inside the city, a rat in a trap. He fights down panic. He planned for this. There are contingencies. But first he has to make it home.
Bangkok is not Malacca. This time you are prepared.
Eventually, the familiar shacks and smells of the Yawarat slums surround them. They slip through tight squeezeways, past the people who do not know him. He forces down another rush of fear. If the white shirts have influenced the slums' godfathers, he could be in danger. He forces the thought away, drags open the door to his hovel, guides Mai inside.
You did well.
He digs in his bag and hands her a bundle of the stolen money.
If you want more, come back to me tomorrow.
She stares at the wealth that he has so casually handed her. If he was smart, he would strangle her and reduce the chances that she will turn on him for the rest of his savings. He forces down the thought. She has been loyal. He must trust someone. And she is Thai, which is useful when yellow cards are suddenly as disposable as Cheshire's. She takes the money and stuffs it into a pocket.
You can find your way from here?
He asks. She grins.
I'm not a yellow card. I don't have anything to fear.
Hak Sung makes himself smile in return, thinking that she does not know how little anyone cares to separate wheat from chaff, when all anyone wants to do is burn a field. Chapter 23.
Goddamn General Pracha and goddamn white shirts!
Carlyle pounds the railing of the apartment. He's unshaven and unbathed. He hasn't been back to the Victory in a week, thanks to the lockdown of the Farang district. His clothing is beginning to show the wear of the tropics. They've got the anchor pads locked down, they've got the locks closed, banned access to the piers. He turns and comes back inside, pours himself a drink. Fucking white shirts. Anderson can't help smiling at Carlyle's irritation. I warned you about poking cobras. Carlyle scowls.
It wasn't me. Someone in trade had a bright idea and went too far. Fucking Jidey.
He fumes.
They should have known better.
Was it Akarat?
He's not that stupid.
It doesn't matter, I suppose. Anderson toasts him with a warm scotch. A week of lockdown, and it looks like the white shirts are just getting started. Carlyle glowers.
Don't look so satisfied. I know you're hurting, too.
Anderson sips. Honestly, I can't say that I care. The factory was useful. Now it's not. He leans forward. Now I want to know if Akarat has really done as much groundwork as you claimed. He nods toward the city. Because it's looking like he's overstretched.
And you think that's funny?
I think that if he's isolated, he needs friends. I want you to reach out to him again. Offer him our sincere support in this crisis.
You've got a better offer than the one that had him threatening to have you trampled?
The price is the same, the gift is the same. Anderson sips again. But maybe Akarat is willing to listen to reason now. Carlyle stares out at the green glow of methane lamps. Grimaces.
I'm losing money every day.
I thought you had leverage with your pumps.
Stop smirking.
Carlyle scowls.
You can't even threaten these bastards. They won't take messengers.
Anderson smiles slightly. Well, I don't feel like waiting until the monsoons for the white shirts to come to their senses. Set up a meeting with Akarat. We can offer him all the help he needs.
You think you'll just swim out to Koh Angrid and lead a revolution back in?
With what?
A couple clerks and shipping captains? Maybe some junior trade rep who sits out there drinking all day and hoping the kingdom will have a famine and drop its embargoes? Pretty threatening.
Anderson smiles. If we come, we'll come from Burma. And no one will notice until it's too late. He holds Carlyle's eyes until the man looks away.
Same terms, Carlyle asks. You're not changing anything?
Access to the Thai seed bank and a man named Gibbons, that's all.
And you'll give what?
What does Akarat need? Money for bribes, gold, diamonds, jade? He pauses. Shock troops.
Christ. You're serious about the Burma thing.
Anderson waves his glass toward the night beyond. My cover here is blown. I accept that and move forward. Or I pack up and head back to Des Moines with my tail between my legs. Let's be honest, Agrigen has always played for keeps. Ever since Vincent Hu and Chitra Delessa started the company. We're not afraid of a little mess.
Like Finland?
Anderson smiles. I'm hoping for a better return on investment this time. Carlyle grimaces.
Christ. All right, I'll set up the meeting, but you better remember me when this is over.
Agrigen always remembers its friends. He ushers Carlyle out the door and closes it behind him, thoughtful. It's interesting to see what crisis brings out in a man. Carlyle, always so cocky and confident, now harried by the realization that he stands out as if he were painted blue, that the white shirts could begin interning Farang or executing them at any time and no one would mourn. Suddenly, Carlyle's confidence is stripped away like a used filter mask. Anderson goes to the balcony and stares out at the darkness, to the waters far beyond, to the island of Koh Angrit, and the powers that wait so patiently at the kingdom's edge. Almost time. Chapter 24. Amid the wreckage of white shirt reprisals, Kanya sits sipping coffee. In the far corner of the noodle shop, a few patrons squat sullenly, listening to a Muay Thai match on a hand-cranked radio. Kanya, monopolizing the customer bench, ignores them. No one dares to sit beside her. Before, they might have hazarded the companionship, but now the white shirts have shown their teeth and she sits alone. Her men have already proceeded ahead of her, ravening like jackals, cleaning out old history and bad alliances, starting fresh. Sweat trickles off the owner's chin as he leans over steaming bowls of rice noodles. Water beads on his face, glinting blue with the flare of illegal methane. He doesn't look at Kanya. Probably rues the day he decided to buy fuel on the black market. The radio's tinny crackle and the faint shout of the Lumpini crowds competes with the burn of the wok as he boils sen mi for soup. None of the listeners look at her. Kanya sips her coffee and smiles grimly. Violence they understand. A soft environment ministry they ignored or scoffed at, but this ministry, one with its batons swinging and spring guns ready to cut a body down, elicits a different response. How many illegal burn stands has she already trashed? Ones just like this one. Ones where some poor coffee or noodle man couldn't afford the kingdom's taxed and sanctioned methane. Hundreds, she supposes. Methane is expensive. Bribes are cheaper. And if black market fuel lacked the additives that turned the methane a safe shade of green, well, that was a risk they all took willingly.
We were so easy to bribe.
Kanya pulls out a cigarette and lights it on the demanding blue flame under the man's wok. He doesn't stop her. Acts as though she doesn't exist. A comfortable fiction for both of them. She is not a white shirt sitting at his illegal burn stand. He is not a yellow card that she could throw into the towers to sweat and die with his countrymen. She draws on her cigarette, thoughtful. Even if he doesn't show his fear, she knows his feelings. Remembers when the white shirts came to her own village. They filled her aunt's fish ponds with lye and salt and burned her poultry in slaughter piles. You're lucky, yellow card. When the white shirts came for us, they didn't care about preserving anything at all. They came with their torches and they burned and burned. You'll get better treatment than we did. The memory of those sooty pale men, demon-eyed, behind biohazard masks, makes her want to cower even now. They came at night. There was no warning. Her neighbors and cousins fled naked and screaming ahead of the torches. Behind them, their stilt houses erupted in flames, bamboo and palm, roaring orange and alive in the blackness. Ash swirled around them, scalding skin, sending everyone coughing and retching. She still carries scars from that burning. Pale pox where flakes of burning palm landed hot and permanent on her thin childish arms. How she hated the white shirts. She and her cousins had huddled together, watching in awe and terror as the environment ministry raised their village, and she had hated them with all her heart. And now, she marshals her own troops to do the same. Jaidi would appreciate the irony. In the distance, shouts of fear rise up like smoke, as black and oily as farmers' hovels burning. Kanya sniffs. It's nostalgic in a way. The smoke is the same. She draws on her cigarette, exhales. Wonders if her men have gotten ahead of themselves. A fire in these Weatherall slums would be problematic. The oils that keep the wood from rotting ignite easily in the heat. She takes another puff of her cigarette. Nothing she can do about it now. Perhaps it is only an officer torching illegally scavenged scrap. She reaches out to sip her coffee and eyes the bruise on the cheek of the man who serves her. If the environment ministry had anything to say about it, all these yellow card refugees would be on the other side of the border. A Malayan problem. The problem of another sovereign country. Not a problem for the kingdom at all. But Her Royal Majesty the Child Queen is merciful. Compassionate in a way Kanya is not. Kanya snuffs her cigarette. It's a good tobacco. Gold leaf. Local engineering. Better than anything else in the kingdom. She pulls another cigarette from its switchgrass cellophane box. Lights it on the blue flame. The yellow card keeps his expression polite as Kanya motions for him to pour more sweet coffee. The radio crackles with the stadium's cheers, and the men huddling around it all cheer as well, momentarily forgetting the white shirt nearby. The footsteps are almost silent, timed with the sound of pleasure, but the yellow card's expression gives the arrival away. Kanya doesn't look up. She motions for the man standing behind to join her.
"Either kill me or sit down," she says.
A low chuckle. The man sits. Narang wears a loose, black, high-collar shirt and gray trousers. Tidy clothes. He could work as a clerk, perhaps. Except for his eyes. His eyes are too alert. And his body is too relaxed. There is an easy confidence to him. An arrogance that has difficulty fitting into his clothes. Some people are simply too powerful to pretend a lower status. It made him stand out at the anchor pads as well. She bottles her anger, waits without speaking.
"You like the silk?"
He touches his shirt.
"It's Japanese."
"They still have silkworms." She shrugs.
"I don't like anything about you, Narang."
He smiles at that.
"Come now, Kanya. Here you are, promoted to captain and not a single smile on you."
He motions to the yellow card for coffee. They watch the rich brown liquid splash into a glass. The yellow card sets a bowl of soup down before Kanya. Fish balls and lemongrass and chicken stock. She starts fishing out Utex noodles. Narang sits quietly, patiently.
"You asked for this meeting,"
he says finally.
"Did you kill Chaya?"
Narang straightens.
"You always lacked social grace. Even after all these years in the city and all the money we've given to you, you might as well be a Mekong fish farmer."
Kanya looks at him coldly. If she's honest with herself, he frightens her. But she won't let that show. Behind her, Another cheer from the radio.
You're the same as Bracha. You're all disgusting, she says.
You didn't think so when we came to you, a very small and vulnerable girl, and invited you to Bangkok. You didn't think so when we supported your aunt through the rest of her years. You didn't think so when we offered you an opportunity to strike at General Pracha and the White Shirts.
There are limits. Chaya did nothing.
Narong is as still as a spider, regarding her. Finally, he says, Jaidee overstepped himself. You even warned him. Be careful that you don't dive down the cobra's throat yourself.
Kanya starts to speak, then closes her mouth.
Starts again, keeping her voice under control.
Will you do the same to me as you did to Jaidee?
Kanya, how long have I known you?
Narong smiles. How long have I cared for your family?
You are our valued daughter.
He slides a thick envelope across to her. I would never hurt you, he says.
We are not like Pracha.
Narong pauses.
How is the loss of the tiger affecting the department?
Look around you.
Kanya jerks her head toward the sounds of conflict.
The general is enraged. Jaidee was almost a brother to him.
I hear he wants to come after trade directly. Maybe even burn the ministry to the ground.
Of course he wants to go after trade. Without trade, our problems would be halved.
Narong shrugs. The envelope sits between them. It might as well be Jaidee's heart laying on the counter. The return on her long-ago investment in revenge.
I'm sorry, Jaidee. I tried to warn you.
She takes the envelope, empties the money, and stuffs it into a belt pouch as Narong looks on. Even the man's smiles are sharp with cutting edges. His hair is slicked back on his head, sleek. He is both entirely still and entirely terrifying.
And this is the sort you consort with, mutters a voice inside her head.
Kanya jerks at the voice. It sounds like Jaidee. It has the telltales of Jaidee, of his humor and his relentlessness, the hint of laughter along with judgment. Jaidee never lost his sense of Sanuk.
I'm not your kind,
Kanya thinks. Again the grin and the chuckle.
I knew that.
Why didn't you simply kill me if you knew?
The voice is silent. The sound of the Muay Thai match continues to crackle behind them. Charoen and Sakta. A good match. But either Charoen has radically improved or Sakta has been paid to fail. Kanya's bet will be a losing one. The match reeks of interference. Perhaps the Dung Lord has taken an interest in the fight. Kanya makes a face of irritation.
Bad match? Narong asks. I always bet on the wrong man.
Narong laughs. That's why it's so helpful to have information ahead of time. He hands her a scrap of paper. Kanya looks through the names on the list.
These are Pracha's friends, generals, some of them. They're protected by him as the cobra sheltered the Buddha.
Narong grins. That's why they will be so surprised when he suddenly turns on them.
Hit them.
Make them hurt. Let them know that the Environment Ministry is not to be trifled with. That the Ministry views all infractions equally. No more favoritism. No more friendships and easy deals. Show them that this new Environment Ministry is unbending.
You're trying to drive a wedge between Pracha and his allies. Make them angry at him.
Narong shrugs. Doesn't say anything. Kanya finishes her noodles. When no other instructions seem to be forthcoming, she stands.
I must go. I can't have my men see me with you.
Narong nods, dismissing her. Kanya stalks out of the coffee shop, followed by new groans of disappointment from the radio listeners as Sakta is cowed by Charoen's newfound ferocity. On the street corner, under the green glow of methane, Kanya straightens her uniform. There is a blotchy stain on her jacket, residue of the destruction she has wreaked tonight. She frowns with distaste, brushes at it, again opens the list that Narong gave her, memorizing the names. The men and women are General Pracha's closest friends, and they will now be enforced against as vigorously as the yellow cards in their towers. As vigorously as General Pracha once enforced against a small village in the northeast, leaving starving families and burning homes behind him. Difficult. But for once, fair. Kanya crumples the list in her hand.
This is the shape of our world, she thinks. Tit for tat until we're all dead and Cheshire's lap at our blood.
She wonders if it was really better in the past, if there really was a golden age fueled by petroleum and technology, a time when every solution to a problem didn't engender another. She wants to curse those Farang who came before, the calorie men with their active labs and their carefully cultured crop strains that would feed the world, their modified animals that would work so much more efficiently on fewer calories. The agrigens and purcows who claimed that they were happy to feed the world, to export their patented grains, and then always found a way to delay.
Ah, Jaiti, she thinks. I am sorry, so sorry, for everything I have done to you and yours. I did not set out to hurt you. If I had known how much it would cost to balance against Pracha's greed, I would have never come to Krung Thep.
Instead of going after her men, she makes her way to a temple. It is small, a neighborhood shrine more than anything, with only a few monks in attendance. A young boy kneels before the glittering Buddha image with his grandmother, but otherwise the place is empty. Kanya buys some incense from the vendor at the gate and goes inside. She lights the incense and kneels, holds the burning sticks to her forehead, raises them three times in the triple gem. Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. She prays.
How many evils has she committed? How much bad karma must she atone for? Was it more important to honor Akarat and his promises of a balancing of the scales? Or was it more important to honor her adoptive father, Jaiti?
A man comes to your village with a promise of food for your belly, a life in the city, and money for your aunt's cough and your uncle's whiskey, and he doesn't even want to buy your body. What else can one wish for? What else could buy loyalty? Everyone needs a patron.
May you have much better friends in your next life, loyal fighter. Ah, Jaiti, I am sorry. May I wander as a ghost for a million years to make atonement. May you be reborn in a better place than this.
She stands and makes a final vow to the Buddha and goes out of the temple. On the steps, she looks up at the stars. She wonders how it is that her karma has so destroyed her. She closes her eyes, fighting back tears. In the distance, a building explodes in flame. She has over 100 men working this district, letting everyone feel the pain of real enforcement. Laws are a fine thing on paper, but painful when no bribery can ease their bind. People have forgotten this. Suddenly she feels tired. She turns away from the carnage. She has enough blood and soot in her hands for one night. Her men know their work. Home is not far.
Captain Kanya!
Kanya opens her eyes to dawn light filtering into her home. For a moment she is too groggy to remember anything about the days, about her position.
Captain!
The voice is calling in through her screened window. Kanya pulls herself out of bed and goes to her door.
Yes,
she calls through.
What is it? You're wanted at the ministry.
Kanya opens the door and takes an envelope from the man, unbinds the seal.
This is from the quarantine department,
she says, surprised. He nods.
It was a volunteer duty that Captain Jaidi had.
He trails off.
With everyone working, General Pracha asked...
He hesitates. Kanya nods.
Yes, of course.
Her skin crawls, remembering Jaidi's stories of the wars against early strains of cibiscosis. How he worked with his heart in his throat alongside his men, all of them wondering who would die before the week was done. All of them in a terror of sickness and a sweat of work as they burned whole villages, homes and wats and Buddha images all going up in smoke, while monks chanted and called spirits to their aid and people all around them lay on the ground and died, gagging on fluids as their lungs ruptured. Quarantine department. She reads the message, nods sharply to the boy.
Yes, I see. Any return?
No. She sets the envelope on a side table. A scorpion crouched.
This is all I need.
The messenger salutes and runs down the steps to his bicycle. Kanya closes the door, thoughtful. The envelope hints at horrors. Perhaps this is her karma. Retribution. In a short time, she is on her way to the ministry, cycling through leafy streets, crossing canals, coasting down city boulevards built for 5 lanes of petroleum-burning cars that now carry herds of megadonts. At the quarantine department, she endures a second security check before she is allowed to enter the complex. Computer and climate fans hum relentlessly. The whole building seems to vibrate with the energy burning within. More than 3/4 of the ministry's carbon allocation goes to this single building, the brain of the quarantine department that evaluates and predicts the shifts in genetic architecture that necessitate a ministry response. Behind glass walls, LEDs on servers wink red and green, burning energy, drowning Krung Tep even as they save it. She walks down the halls, past a series of rooms, where scientists sit before giant computer screens and study genetic models on the brightly glowing displays. Kanya imagines that she can feel the air combusting with all the energy being burned, all the coal being consumed to keep this single building running. There are stories of the raids that were necessary to create the quarantine department, of the strange marriages that gave them footholds in these technologies. Farang brought across at great expense. Foreign experts used to transfer the viruses of their knowledge, the invasive concepts of their gene-rip criminality to the kingdom. The knowledge needed to preserve the Thai and keep them safe in the face of the plagues. Some of these people are famous now, as important in folklore as Ajahn Chah and Chart Korbjiti and Subnakasatian. Some of them have become bodies in their own right, merciful spirits, dedicated to the salvation of an entire kingdom. She passes through a courtyard. In the corner, a small spirit house sits, housing miniature statues of teacher Lalji, looking like a small wizened sadhu, and the Agrigen Saint Sarah. The twinned bodies, male and female, the calorie bandit and the gene ripper, the thief and the builder. There are only a few incense sticks burning, the usual plate of breakfast and garlands of marigolds that are always strung. When the plagues are bad, The place seethes with prayers as scientists struggle to find a solution. Even our prayers are to the Farang.